That was like a really cool thing. Fran took me actually to the play to see
yes,
Come From Away.
Hartford.
What was it called? It was called Come From Away?
Yeah, it was called Come From Away.
Yeah.
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 And so,
it was awesome. It was really, you know, it was an eye opener to me. I had no idea about what had happened up there.
Right.
Well,
cool. What was very funny about that play is that you saw An Ordinary Day in Newfoundland, and you saw, you know, this sort of self-important Newfie guy who was the mayor, and they were talking about, they were arguing with the bus drivers about something very mundane in a very humorous way, because one of the things that Newfies are, by the way, Newfie is short for Newfoundlander, one of the things Newfies are very funny. They are among the funniest people in Newfoundland, and in fact, in Newfoundland began a show called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. And if you like The Daily Show, you know, Jon Stewart, Trevor Noah, whatever, they in Newfoundland originated this show called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. I don't know that it's filmed there now. It may be filmed in Nova Scotia or in Toronto at this point. But it was originated there, and it didn't star one person. It was an ensemble. And I remember it was Rick Mercer, Kathy Jones, Mary... I could probably look that up. And there were a couple more. Kathy Jones, I actually knew her personally. And Rick Mercer was one of the guys that put it together. And, you know, I think it's still going on now, but obviously it has different players. But so Newfoundland had this great spirit of humor, and they also have a great spirit of kindness. Newfoundland happens to be the most economically depressed province in the country. And so people know what it's like to be poor, because it was mainly a fishing economy. And out in the outports, when I lived there, I lived there from 1995 to 1997, there was 70% unemployment in the outport towns. Probably not as bad in the cities, but in the outport towns, because the fishing, there was a cod moratorium because the European fishing boats had fished out the cod. And so people couldn't go cod fishing. So the province of Newfoundland, they have a big thing about taking care of each other. And one of the things that was amazing about Newfoundland is that, for example, here, when I go do a charity run or ride or something like that, and I ask people for money, there are times when I will not get any donations. People just don't feel like they can give money. When I'll put a box out, or I'll put out a can, and people will not contribute. When I was in Newfoundland, I did a race called the Terry Fox Run. It was just a 5K that was happening in St. John's, and they have Terry Fox Runs all over all over Canada. And he was a gentleman who had cancer, who was promoting cancer awareness, and he ran across Canada. And then I think ultimately he died, but they have these Terry Fox Runs to raise money for cancer. So I went around my office and I asked people, I did that coy thing, do you think you'd like to donate? They didn't think twice. They looked at me and said, okay, how much? Here you go. And they didn't even, every single person, it didn't matter who it was. The attitude was so different. This is the poorest province in Canada, and they get, per capita, they give the most in charity. That's a fact about Newfoundland. So when 9/11 happened, a lot of planes were diverted. They couldn't fly into New York, you know, wherever they were going. If they were going, a lot of people were not even, New York was not even their final destination. They were switching up in New York, but the airspace was closed there. So they landed a lot of planes that were coming from Europe in Gander, Newfoundland. And Gander is not the biggest place in Newfoundland. It's a smallish town, but it's a big, one of the bigger towns in Newfoundland. See, the way it works in Newfoundland is that you got the Trans-Canada that goes across Newfoundland. It's the main highway, and all the roads that go to anywhere else, they're off of the Trans-Canada. It's not like when you're in Connecticut, well, you could get there by way of 84, and you could get there by 95, and you could get there by the Mass Pike or 395. You have, in St. John's, you have mile one of the Trans-Canada, like you have mile one of the I-95 down in Key West. Mile one of the Trans-Canada, and it goes across, and that's how you get anywhere. You get off and you go across the province that way. And it goes all the way to Corner Brook, and then it turns, bends south, and it goes all the way to Port-au-Basque, where you can get the ferry and get over to Nova Scotia. That's where you get the big ferries to go to Nova Scotia, and that's the closest way to get to get back to the mainland. So access to St. John's, you know, we used to travel The reason I was there was because I fell in love with a man, not you. His name was Bill.
Hey,
Bill Harvey. So shout out to Bill Harvey and all of the Harveys. It didn't ultimately work out, but I'm still friends with his sisters, Maggie and Frances. Maggie's actually down in Florida, and Frances is she's in Florida because her grandmother lived there, and she ultimately wound up there. And Frances is out in she's in a Toronto suburb, maybe Hamilton, one of the Toronto suburbs at this time. And that's one of the unfortunate things about Newfoundland, because of the economy, people leave. They have a brain drain problem there, unfortunately. And Maggie and Frances left, so did Bill. Anyway, so when we would drive for Christmas, we would go to where we were living in St. John's, and where Bill was going to school and I was working, and we would drive across the province to go see the parents at Christmas. And they lived in Lark Harbor, which is a town, a little tiny outport town in the Bay of Islands outside of Corner Brook. And that's where Bill's parents lived, because Bill's dad wanted to get away from England and do his own thing, and, you know, had a pioneering spirit. And so we would go to Lark Harbor. And one of the places we would stop was Gander, Newfoundland. So, like I said, Gander was just a little bit of a bigger town. It wasn't as big as Corner Brook or St. John's. That it was just a place where you would stop. But it was a bigger place, and it was called Gander because of Goose Bay, which is in Labrador. So Happy Valley Goose Bay is a place in Labrador. And
Goose and a gander.
Exactly. So there were two army bases there. Mm-hmm. There were U.S. Army bases there. And so there were airports there. So that's why you had Gander and Goose Bay. And that's why it was called Gander. It's kind of clever, right?
It's clever.
Yeah.
It's definitely clever.
So what happened was a lot of planes got diverted, and they landed in Gander, and they spent a few days in Gander before they could go on to their final destinations. And the people of Gander came out in force and took care of everybody. And so if you go see that play Come From Away, it's a kind of a dramatization and musicalization of that story. And they got a lot of things right. They got the humor right. They got the accents pretty much right. They got the different things that go on in the town, like the humorous sluggishness of town politics in Newfie accents. The things that they ate, they screeched the people in. There was a lot of things that, so it was very, it was a lot of fun to watch in that sense. And also heartwarming, because the people of Newfoundland, they came out in force to take care of people on the moment. That no questions were asked. They just went out and took care of people, which was just really beautiful. I remember when I lived there, people didn't lock their doors. It was one of those kinds of places. And I also remember
they don't lock them around here.
I know. I remember coming home from somewhere. We were coming back from we might have been coming home from driving down to Florida for Christmas, and we had just got off the ferry in Port au Basque, and there was somebody by the side of the road that was having car trouble. 10 people had stopped to help him. That's just what you see there. It's really a delightful place. So, testament to the human spirit. Shout out to Newfoundland. Shout out to my friends in Newfoundland. My hearts also go out to any of us who were directly affected by 9/11. And let's hope and pray that in this day and age, we can figure out a way to peace, that we can pray for peace, and that we can that peace can come in our time, and not in a horrific way, not with an apocalypse, but that people just decide that war is not the answer anymore, and that war is good for nobody, and that greed and all the greed and avarice and hawkishness that comes with fighting, that's set aside, that in our time we can know peace. Let's hope that can happen in our time. And this is something we talk about because we're getting into the high holidays, and we talk about in the days of awe leading up to the high holidays, and then during the high holidays. Oh gosh, during the high holidays, this is something we talk about. We pray for peace. We pray for peace all the time, but we pray for peace at the high holidays, especially. Because at the high holidays, it's a time of reflection. It's a time to think about who you are, what your place is in the world, and you do an inventory of yourself. Not that you shouldn't be doing that all the time, because you do. But the high holidays, you know, it's a time of reflection of yourself as a person, and also you reflect upon yourself along with your community. And so Tikkun Olam is a huge principle in Judaism, which means repairing the world. And so it's something that we really think about, and we think about it a little bit more this time of year. And 9/11 last year happened, I believe, during the Selichot. It was definitely the days leading up to the high holidays, because at that time, my parents were still living in New Jersey. As I said, my mother was still teaching, and she had students whose parents were affected by 9/11, some who perished and some who were simply affected by it. I drove home. I remember Rosh Hashanah was, I think Erev Rosh Hashanah was the 19th, which was a week and a day later. So I drove, when I drove from Connecticut, I drove across the George Washington Bridge, and I drove on the top deck, and I looked over, and I could see the site of the Twin Towers. There was a line of smoke that went straight up, and then it went straight perpendicular. And if I remember correctly, it went across the Hudson River. And so if it went across the Hudson River, it was traveling west, right? So there was a west wind, and it made the smoke go west. But it smoked for years. And then the other thing that happened was after 9/11, so that happened on 9/11, you know, 9/11 happened, and then that was a week later. I went home from Rosh Hashanah, and I saw that, and I heard stories from other people about where they were when they found out and what was going on. About a year later, a little over a year later, I took up with my old friend Gary, and we decided we were going to date. And so Gary lived in the Bronx, and I lived in Willimantic. And so we had a long distance relationship for a while. So in the course of that long distance relationship, we would switch off who would go see each other. So it was kind of cool, because every 2 weeks I was going to New York. And that was kind of fun. I kind of liked that. And every 2 weeks, the alternate weeks, he would come see me in Connecticut, and with our plan ultimately to wind up in one place, probably Connecticut. And Gary did wind up in Connecticut. So I knew that I was going to be visiting New York regularly. So I felt like the first time I visited New York, Manhattan specifically, with Gary, I said, I can't by right enjoy New York City unless I first go to the 9/11 memorial and honor that this happened. And I don't feel right just partying in a place where something so serious happened, that I should go and remember the people that suffered with 9/11. So we went to the memorial, we went to the site, and said some prayers, and there were some things. It was still very rudimentary at that point. There wasn't, right now they rebuilt a building and a memorial there, and it's a nice place that you can go. And but at that time there was still a cavern, there's still a hole, and there was not, it was only a year later. So memorial stuff was still pieces of paper that were taped to a fence. So, it felt really good to be able to go there and remember those people. And, very sad and very moving as well. So anyway, today being 9/11, I thought I would talk about that.
It's a good thing. There's, a number of obvious health effects that happen from 9/11. I sent you over a link to a Wikipedia page, but I don't know if it came through because I'm having some technical issues. The big one is the toxic dust that came from the collapsed towers.
Mm-hmm.
According to air pollution experts at the University of California, Davis, much of the thousands of tons of debris resulting from the collapse of the Twin Towers was pulverized concrete, which is also known to cause silicosis upon inhalation. The remainder consisted of more than 2,500 contaminants, more specifically 50% non-fibrous material and construction debris, 40% glass and other fibers, 9.2% cellulose, and 0.8% 90% of the extremely toxic carcinogen asbestos, right, as well as detectable amounts of lead and mercury. There are also unprecedented levels of dioxins and PAHs from which the fires burned for 3 months. So just really like a mess. So yeah, that's why people were really hurt. They were really sick from it. And a number of people had died from it. And I had that up too until my computer decided to burp. But so, I'll find it again. Just an unbelievable of, you know, the numbers are really frightening as to the effects that 9/11 had on all of us and all those poor people that went in there to save people's lives. It's just horrible.
And they just breathe toxic amounts of dust. So if asbestos, when you breathe asbestos in, asbestos is a carcinogen. Some of the other compounds simply shouldn't be in your lungs, and they just wreck your lungs, and you get a condition called pneumoconiosis. You get interstitial lung disease, where the actual substance of your lung tissue gets compromised by silicosis. Silicosis is something that can cause pneumoconiosis. So when you get particulate matter in your lungs that shouldn't be there, it wrecks the lung parenchyma, the lung tissue. And then when you're breathing, you said PAHs, those are polyaromatic hydrocarbons, and you said dioxins and PCBs, mm-hmm, all of these can be carcinogens. So you have this storm of, particulate matter that's ruining the lung tissue. You can't breathe it out properly. You have asbestos that's sitting in the lungs and can't get out. That's the other thing, that once these tiny particulates get into the lungs, they can't get out. You breathe them into the alveoli, and they're small enough that they can get into the lung tissue. So when you have lung, you have the stuff that holds the lungs together, and then you have the actual alveoli, which are the air sacs. And so when you breathe stuff in that can't easily get out, then you can get into a situation where the lung tissue doesn't function properly. And once the particulate matter gets into the lung tissue, you get restrictive lung disease, where the lungs can't expand and contract to push substances out. So these substances get stuck. And, so if you have just silica won't necessarily give you cancer, but it makes it so the lungs can't work. But then if the lungs aren't working properly, and then you have PCBs and polyaromatic hydrocarbons in there, then you have a situation where you're more likely to get cancer. The other thing that happened is you saw kidney cancers with these people, and that's partially, again, there's probably an issue where these toxins got stuck in the kidneys. The kidneys are desperately trying to filter them out, and it got into the kidney tissue and caused cancer. It's just the level of toxins that got into these people was so much that that many, many people got sick. It's just pretty amazing. And so, kudos and nachas and, a lot of wonderful things to John Stewart, who helped so that the survivors of these illnesses could get federally funded medical care for the rest of their lives, because they did what Mark Scrivener says that firefighters do. They ran into a burning building to try to save people's lives. And then rescue workers went in after the fires had calmed down. And the fires burned, you said, for a couple of 3 months after? That it was smoldering for how long after?
Oh, God. It was 3 months. Yeah,
the smoldering 3 months. For 3 months. So we're talking about this stuff is still burning, and people are going in there. Rescue workers are digging through the rubble trying to find people. So for as long as it took. So it was so people were had high exposure levels. And I'm guessing that as they were looking for people, they probably had gas masks on, but they were inadequate.
No, they didn't. A lot of them didn't. I mean, some didn't. But I'm looking through pictures here right now, and quite a few did not. I mean, they didn't know. They had no idea what they were stepping into. That was Eagle Moon who just called us, and she just a quick shout out to her. She said there were a number of people from the alternative medicine world, Reiki people and all, that were helping some of the first responders afterwards, and she just wanted to make a big shout out to them too.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. So. Yeah, that's really great. Yeah. So, Yeah. So what a thing. Today, at the moments that, you know, the anniversary of the moments that the planes hit the towers, there were moments of silence. There were national, international moments of silence and ceremonies.
So many people talk about, too, where were you the day of, you know, and everyone has that story.
Yeah.
That's how permanent that is in in our brains. My poor friend, Kevin, who was, he was with, I was working for Fuji Bicycles at the time, and Kevin was instructing a lot of the New York City police officers on how to, you know, how to ride their bikes. And they were just starting to put a bicycle force into the city. And he lost a bunch of friends on that one because they were there. They were a bunch of members from the Port Authority that were there. It's just really sad.
Yeah.
Really, really sad. He said he went to, I believe he told me he went to 15 funerals that week.
Wow. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing about being from right around here is you probably knew somebody who was directly affected, you know, or if you didn't have a relative that was directly affected. And the thing with the United States is the other side of it is not to diminish what happened on that day is that we are very blessed that war is not a day-to-day factor in our lives. We don't live in a place where
in this country
we're in a war zone. Well, that's what I mean on our soils.
Right.
Although we've
right.
got too many people with guns, and we have that situation where you know you're going about your everyday life, and then all of a sudden, you know, terror can break out in a Walmart. But but on the other hand, we don't live in a place where there's constant war. And so for that to come to our country was very, very strange and very unusual. And we're very blessed that this is not a day-to-day part of our existence, as terrible as that was, you know, that happened on that day. And that's not something that happens frequently in our country. I mean, it was 18 years ago already, and we haven't had anything of that scope happen again. What we do have, of course, is these unfortunate, mass shootings, which that's a whole other problem, because they're so random. They can happen anywhere. You never know where and when they're going to happen. So again, repairing the world, fixing what's going on. So people don't want to do that. There's so many directions you can go with that. And having people have access to the things they need to have happy lives, that would go a long way to helping this sort of thing. And you know, just having justice, you know, political, social, economic justice for people everywhere, that would go a long way to prevent stuff like this.
Yeah, sure would.
Yeah.
So. Well, there's many things we could do, but anyway. It's tough because, you know, that kind of anger and rage that would create an event like that is something that really needs to be understood better.
Yeah.
I think that is a beginning of the solution to the problem. But, you know, like, why would anyone do something like that? What makes people that angry to be able to feel that they must do something that violent?
Yeah.
And that's what you got to look at. I mean, it's a thing.
Yeah. So on this 9/11, let's move on for a little bit to something else that's important, and then a teaser for the next thing that we'll talk about. So I want to just run through Eastern equine encephalitis for a little bit, because mosquitoes have been found in Connecticut that contain Eastern equine encephalitis, and guess where the latest place that they were publicized to have been found?
Oh, the epicenter, Connecticut.
I'm talking about the town.
Mansfield?
I'll give you a hint. Their mascot is the Colonels.
Oh, Ledyard.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
I grew
Ledyard,
up there.
Right, exactly. Mm. So Ledyard, Ledyard's ending all football games and practices at 6:30.
No way.
Yes.
Because why?
They're worried about mosquitoes because the crepuscular time begins at 6:30.
Oh.
And until there's a hard freeze and the mosquito season goes away, that's going to continue.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're worried about Eastern equine encephalitis. The thing is that the incidence of Eastern equine encephalitis is very low. That's the thing that's interesting. That Yeah, I mean, obviously, you don't want to be, you want to do your best to not get bitten by mosquitoes. So you have a couple of options there because it is mosquito borne. It has been found in Connecticut. It's very rare, but it is serious. It grows in birds that live in freshwater. It grows in freshwater swamps and is only found in those birds and the mosquitoes that bite them. And it actually is found in mosquitoes that that don't usually bite people, but there are mosquitoes that do bite people that sometimes get it, and that's how it's spread. It's spread in humans by mosquitoes. Anyone can get it if they're bitten by infected mosquito, but most mosquitoes don't have it. The greatest risk is from late July to mid-October. Once you start getting really cold weather and the mosquitoes die back, then you're not going to have to worry about it as much. Today would not be a good day. The symptoms, you get a high fever, stiff neck, and you're getting encephalitis. Encephalitis is a swelling of the brain. So you could get a meningitis and encephalitis. And some patients quickly go into a coma because of brain swelling. It's very dangerous. And you can get symptoms within 3 to 10 days. There's no cure. And 3 of every 10, so not everybody dies of it, but 30% do when you get it. So what you want to do is not get bitten by mosquitoes. So if you live in a place where there are a lot of mosquitoes, I hate to say this, you might want to consider using DEET. Because DEET, DEET is toxic, but, you know, put it on while you're going to be outside, cover up. And when you get inside and you're not going to be outside for the rest of the day, take a shower and get the DEET off you. Mm-hmm. There is another product there's a couple of things that you can use that are natural that are not as toxic as DEET. And that's the bio products containing bio UD, which is a tomato based insect or a tomato based insect repellent. And I don't think it smells the best, but I think it doesn't smell as bad as DEET. But it just has a weird pungent odor. But you know what? When I go hiking in Mansfield Hollow and wherever I go, when I go out for walks, and I've taken to, even when I'm on my bike, carrying bug repellent, because even if I'm going too fast for the bugs, I might stop. If I'm on a bike ride with other people and somebody gets a flat, you're going to be standing around by the side of the road, I'm going to wear bug repellent. I'm just, you know, if I'm spending time outside, if I'm spending extensive time outside, I'm wearing bug repellent now. So so the Bio UD is this neat tomato based, naturally based insect repellent, and it's supposed to work pretty well. I must say that when I put it on, I don't think I get bitten. I'm worried about ticks too, of course, because the incidence, I've just seen so much Lyme disease, and this year I've seen a lot of babesiosis as well, the intracellular parasite that is a co-infection of Lyme disease and can also be found in the ticks. So I'm going out and I'm wearing insect repellent every single time. I haven't used DEET. I do use the Bio UD. I like to use the other thing that helps to repel mosquitoes that's natural is lemon eucalyptus. So it's a variety of eucalyptus that has a, you know, limonenes and a citrusy scent to it. So it's kind of nice. So if you find a bug repellent that has lemon eucalyptus in it, it can help to protect you against mosquitoes. And you might want to consider using, bug repellent as part of your hygiene. This time of year, just use it as part of your hygiene. When you go outside, if you're going to wear the sunscreen, put on bug repellent too. You can get combo products, which I think is very clever. Sunscreen with bug repellent in it, if you want to just carry one bottle. You could carry both. And again, if you find the smell of your insect repellent has gone away, reapply. But if you're going to be anywhere where there are mosquitoes. So for me, certainly if I'm out in what we call the crepuscular time, that's, you know, dawn, and the crepuscular time of day is dawn and dusk. And right now, you know, you have to watch what time of day dawn and dusk are going to be. The sun is, of course, it's starting to rise later and later. We're starting to lose minutes at an alarming rate at either end of the day. Good times. And so right now, the crepuscular time it's starting at around probably 6:30. And, you know, it goes till 7:30, 8 o'clock. And then, you know, they're not as prevalent after that time. But if you're going to be outside for any length of time, where there can be mosquitoes and ticks, I think it's a good idea to wear bug repellent. I don't care what time of day it is. It's better to be safe. So yeah. So you can find stuff with, if you're in a really bad area, it might be a good idea to use the DEET and just wash off and take milk thistle and do liver tonics, you know, and eat your lemon and beets and carrots and, take your milk thistle, maybe dandelion root tea, or use bio-UD, something with bio-UD in it, or something with lemon eucalyptus in it, and that can help to repel the mosquitoes. To repel ticks, one thing that's also helpful is rose geranium, any bug repellent that has rose geranium in it. That's something you can use.
Yeah. You know the guys at the solar place I work there?
Right.
They use DEET.
Right. Yeah.
They just, it's now a requirement before they get out of the truck. They have to put it on them before because of ticks.
How many people have been sidelined by Lyme disease at your company?
He's lost, between me and three others, so four.
And that's just around here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we don't know about other places in the country. This is on your
right.
your team or your the local branch of your company.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you want to protect mosquitoes from biting you. That means wear repellent. If you're outdoors at dawn or dusk when mosquitoes are most active, you want to wear long sleeve shirts and long pants. Using insect repellent is according to the manufacturer's instructions. Fix any holes in your screens and make sure they're tightly attached to doors and windows. Also, that thing where you get annoyed with me for leaving the door open, I should really close the door.
Yeah.
Don't let stagnant water collect around your home. Mosquitoes can breed in water that collects in ditches, clogged gutters, old tires, wheelbarrows, wading pools, or if when you step up to the little landing at your front door, if there's like a rock there that has a little carve out, that can fill with water and mosquitoes can breed there. I know because I've seen the larvae in there.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have puddles, get rid of the puddles. All we have to do, it's a very shallow puddle, but you wouldn't believe. They breed right there.
Oh, I know they do. And they breed anywhere where there's water. I mean, water is kind of the key thing.
They will breed in a puddle.
They'll breed in a puddle.
So
they
if
will.
You have a puddle outside your house, sweep it away.
Mm-hmm.
Just, disperse the water because we can very easily take a broom out and just sweep the water out of that puddle and no more larvae. So that's good. But, assuming that once the larvae, if you get them out of the water, they're done for. They're not going to turn into adults. I don't know. But that's where they get born. The mosquitoes lay their eggs in puddles, and they don't have to be deep puddles. They can be really shallow. I mean, like I said, this rock in front of our house, we get larvae there. So, and don't camp overnight near freshwater swamps and use mosquito netting on tents.
Mm.
It's just such a bummer that you have to worry about getting bitten by mosquitoes.
And there's a lot of things to worry about. Yeah, I know.
I have to say, though, as concerned as I am for, people getting Eastern equine encephalitis, it's no match for tick-borne illness. I have seen so much Lyme disease. I have seen a lot of Lyme disease and a lot of Babesia this season. And so that's just what I've seen. How many other people are coming down with it? And one of the things that I do see is people getting misdiagnosed, not diagnosed, getting diagnosed late, people being undertreated, underprescribed, people not being able to get to a doctor who takes them seriously. I've seen a lot of...
That's a big one.
A lot of hard stuff. Yeah. So I've had people switch doctors because they were getting inadequate care.
So here's the rule. A good rule to live by is if your doctor doesn't take it seriously, there are many doctors out there. Find another one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I tell people this all the time because we are very fortunate in the fact that we have someone that you work with directly who is very aware of the fact that, this needs to be treated in a serious manner.
Aggressively and until the patient is well.
And he is also very, very quick to listen to your advice, which is helpful.
Yes.
So when I've got, the best of both worlds working with me, it sure makes it a lot better.
Right.
But my knee's still not right.
Yeah.
It's still not right after all this.
We'll have to have a meeting and figure out what to do about that knee. Yeah. We don't know exactly what's going on with it. If you had some tissue, you may still have some spirochetes in there, and you may have some tissue destruction in there. And there's things we can do for both of those things. I don't know if you still have ongoing inflammation, if you still have spirochetes present, or if you have some degeneration, or you have all of the above, and we could probably come at it from all of those directions. So if there's still spirochetes in there, like I said, one of the directions to go would be to actually give you a poultice with castor oil that had some antimicrobial things in it. Like it could theoretically have garlic in it. It could have silver in it. It could have, it could have coconut oil, monolaurin in it. We'd have to decide what to put in it, but something to put on it to drive the anti-inflammatory. You know, it could have cat's claw in it. Other things that kill Lyme, oregano oil would be another good one. Something to drive those items into the knee to help to kill any outstanding spirochetes. So that's one direction to go. And another direction would be to have you take things that reduce inflammation. So that would be one of my favorites currently is CBD, and you can put CBD on topically as well, and that'll help the area, but you can take CBD orally as well. And then also curcumin and fish oil, all of those things can be helpful because they're great anti-inflammatories. And so that's the inflammation. And then if we need to help you rebuild, we could consider glucosamine sulfate, which is something that your body will take on and help to rebuild cartilage. And we can also give you collagen. So collagen or collagen peptides that can be helpful for rebuilding the knee if there is degeneration. So you come at it from a few different directions. You come at it from addressing the microorganisms, addressing the inflammation, and rebuilding the damaged tissue. So isn't naturopathic medicine neat? We look at things from lots of different angles. That's just what we do.
It is neat.
Yeah. So we're not going to just give you one thing and send you out the door. We're going to look at it from a number of different directions, and we're going to help you, we're going to help you with that. Yeah. So interesting. So, that's most of what I wanted to talk about today. I'll just here's a teaser for next week. I wanted to talk about the trouble with vaping. That vaping is very serious. People are dying from vaping. People are getting sick from vaping. And what the heck is going on? And I can explain to you the reasons for that. The thing with vaping is, we thought that vaping would be an answer to smoking, that it couldn't possibly be as dangerous as cigarette smoking. But guess what? It's starting to seem like it is. It's just, it's a different mechanism, but it's just as dangerous. And, I think you can get cancer, but the thing that you do get is lipoid pneumonia. So we're going to delve into that next week. So we were talking about the pneumoconiosis that people got from being in 9/11. Well, you're getting a similar situation. Stuff is getting into the lungs that shouldn't be in the lungs, and they cause lung dysfunction. I mean, what you really want to be breathing is fresh, clean air. That's not entirely easy to do because we have pollution in our environment, but we definitely need to not be inhaling things into our lungs that are not air, unless they're definitely for medicinal purposes and you don't do them all the time. How we tell people to do steam inhalations when they're sick and you put a drop of essential oil in it. Of course, you're putting just one drop of essential oil and when you're vaping, you're breathing in a lot of vape juice. And so there's a lot of stuff going into your lungs. Anyway, so that's our teaser for next week.
Okay.
So I think I'm going to go. Yeah. So You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Storrs.